Zechariah chapter 9, we're going to be focusing on verses 1 through 9 this morning. We're actually starting the second section of Zechariah. Chapters 1 through 8 are made up of two parts. Chapters 1 through 6 were the eight night visions. And chapters 7 and 8 that we finished up last week are a collection of Zechariah's prophecies and messages. But starting today in chapters 9 through 14, the second section of the book, we're going to study two burdens that were placed upon Zechariah. These two burdens are marked out by chapter 9, verse 1, where it says, "The burden of the word of Yahweh." That same phrase is found in chapter 12, verse 1, "The burden of the word of Yahweh against Israel." You have the two sections. So chapters 9, 10, and 11, we're going to study the first burden. Chapters 12, 13, and 14, the second burden. Some English translations do not use the word burden. They use the word message, saying, or word. They say the word of the word of Yahweh. It's because sometimes this word in various Hebrew forms has been used for the burden that has been placed upon the messenger. But its root word means to carry a heavy load. And it does mean burden. That would be the correct translation. But you also have to understand that the burden that has been placed upon him is the word of Yahweh. Not just a heaviness or a heavy load, but actually the word of God placed upon him to give to God's people. This first section has to do with God dealing with the enemies of Israel. Up till now, the Assyrians had captured northern Israel in 722 B.C. The Babylonians had captured the southern kingdom in Jerusalem in 586 B.C. So Jews were being held in Babylon in captivity. They were also the Assyrians were now dwelling in the northern territory where the northern ten tribes were. Remember, 931 B.C. there was a split between north and south. The northern ten tribes of Israel and the southern two tribes, and it was a civil war between them after the death of Solomon as to who would reign as king. And so there was a division amongst the Jews. So the northern ten tribes being separated for about 200 years, 722 B.C., the Assyrians came in and captured them as a judgment from God. And then 586, the Babylonians came in and captured the southern kingdom and carried the children of Israel away captive. During Zechariah's prophecies, the Medo-Persians had already come in and had already defeated the Babylonians. And so the king of Persia was reigning in the former kingdom of Babylon when burdens or prophecies were placed upon Haggai and Zechariah. Zechariah is, of course, the one we're in now. So these came in about 518 B.C., around that time frame when Persia was ruling and had conquered Babylon. This has to do with the enemies of Israel and the prophecies that God gave to Zechariah. And remember, Zechariah means Yahweh remembers. This is supposed to be a word of encouragement to God's people, that even though he judges them and judges them harshly, he still remembers his promise and his covenants. That's very important for us today, is that God remembers his covenant. And of course, our covenant is through Jesus Christ. And by the way, the communion covenant, the blood of the covenant, is found in this chapter. Many messianic prophecies, many quotations by Jesus are found in this chapter, which is why it is so important. So chapter 9, verse 1 starts out, "The burden of the word of Yahweh against the land of Hadrach." A and Damascus its resting place, for the eyes of men and the tribes of Israel are toward Yahweh, also against Hamath, which borders on it. These are the three cities of Assyria, Damascus being its capital. It says in the text that upon Damascus will be its resting place. In Hebrew, it doesn't mean resting as far as being at peace, but actually the judgment of God will rest upon the capital Syria of Assyria, which is Damascus, and these other two cities that are named in the text. God's wrath is going to be against them, and His wrath, His judgment, will rest upon Damascus. Secondly, two cities of the Canaanites at the end of verse 2, and against Tyre and Sidon. Though they are very wise, for Tyre built a tower, a fortress for herself, heaped up silver like the dust and gold like the mud of the streets, behold, Yahweh will cast her out. He will destroy her power in the sea, and she will be devoured by fire. Now, what is interesting about this text is that the Canaanite cities of Tyre and Sidon, the city of Tyre, sat on the seacoast. And different people and their armies, different countries and their armies, tried to come up against this city, this seacoast city, to defeat it. In fact, Nebuchadnezzar came up against it and tried to defeat it, as well as the Assyrians, and could not. But they were starting to penetrate this seacoast city. So what they did in Tyre is they went out to a small island that was about 700 feet offshore, and they built a city out there on this little island. And the walls of the city were about 150 feet high. So you could not penetrate the city. They eventually moved their seacoast city out to this island where they could not be penetrated. Nebuchadnezzar came back and for 13 years tried to go out onto this island in various ways to defeat it and could not. The Assyrians tried for 5 and could not. But wouldn't you know it, Alexander the Great came through, and he took the ruins, the stones from the ruins of the old city that was left on land, took the stones and had his men throw them into the sea until they built a causeway going out to the island. They just kept throwing all the stones and all the materials from the city, from the old city, out to this island, and he eventually defeated them and destroyed the city, and then in the end burned it with fire. Now it's very interesting. Our text says that God is going to bring judgment against Tyre and Sidon, even though they are wise. See, they thought they were building a city that could not be penetrated. But when you're dealing with God, you can't outfox the Lord. When He brings judgment against you because of what you've done to His people, when judgment comes, it will be done. Though they are wise, they built a citadel for herself, heaped up the silver like the dust and gold like the mud of the streets. The Lord will cast her out, destroy her power in the sea, and she will be devoured by fire. And that happened when Alexander the Great came through. Next, the cities of the Philistines. Ashkelon shall see it and fear. Gaza also shall be very sorrowful. And Ekron, for he dried up her expectation. The king shall perish from Gaza, and Ashkelon shall not be inhabited. So these Philistine cities will be wiped out. All of their expectations, all of their hopes are going to be gone because God is going to make them desolate cities. No one will inhabit them. A mixed race shall settle in Ashdod, and I will cut off the pride of the Philistines. God is going to bring in His people, just as when David became king in the Old Testament, the Jebusites were there, and God took on the Jebusites. David actually took the Jebusites, and they became one with God's people. Much like as we studied last time, how the Jews will be on their way to Jerusalem when Christ comes, and the heathen nations are going to be reaching out to them, holding on to the cuffs, the sleeves of their arms, and they're going to be saying, "Take us with you." There will be nations that will see these people who have been left over from God's judgment of war against these cities. God is going to cause the leftover people, the ones who have survived the judgment, to actually turn to the Lord, actually be what we call proselytes. Be a proselyte Jew is to not be a Jewish person, but to join Judaism and join the Jewish following of Yahweh. And many people did this in the Old Testament. They came in and they submitted to God's law. They submitted to the Hebrew people. They're called proselytes. And many who will be left over from the judgment will come, and they will be mixed with God's people that He's going to bring into the land. He says in verse 7, "I will take away the blood from his mouth." The word blood in Hebrew is actually in the plural. It's bloods. And it's making reference to the blood sacrifices that the heathen would make. This is not God's people, but they were actually, and this is kind of the theme today, they're kind of mixing Judaism and the practices of Judaism with their own heathen practices. We will see in our study in 1 Corinthians 10 this morning, this is called idolatry to the Christian. We will have it explained to us. Idolatry to the Christian is when you bring anything from the world into the things of the Lord and mix them. It's happening in the church today. We're bringing the things of the world into the church, and the Lord calls that idolatry. It doesn't have to do with specifically worshiping a particular idol or statue. It has to do with anything that man serves with his lust, as we will see in 1 Corinthians 10. Bringing that into the church, just as the children of Israel, remember they were in bondage in Egypt, but they were so influenced by the Egyptian culture and religious practices that they incorporated it into the things of God that God was teaching them. They couldn't just break off and leave off from the old life. They had to bring the desires from the old life and bring it into and incorporate it with the things of the Lord. So if we can't get satisfied by the world, it's called lust and it's called sin, we just make an activity in the church to satisfy it and it's okay. God says no. That's idolatry. And we'll see that later on. But these, "I will take away from them the bloods from his mouth and the abominations from between his teeth. For the one who remains, even he shall be for our God, and he shall be like a leader in Judah, and Ekron like the Jebusite." Again, as the Jebusites mixed with David and the Hebrew people, so those left in the land will mix with God's people, and God will be their God, and they will all have one God, according to this. Other cities will be uninhabited and made desolate. Verse 8. "I will camp around my house because of the army, because of him who passes by and him who returns. No more shall an oppressor pass through them, for now I have seen with my eyes." In Exodus chapter 3, this whole introduction of God hearing and God seeing is presented to us. God says, "I have heard the prayers of my people. I have seen the oppression against my people, and I am going to act." God sees with his eyes that even though he's bringing judgment against his people and discipline against his people. He's allowed the Assyrians to come in. He's allowed the Canaanites. He's allowed the Philistines to come in and harass and oppress his people as a judgment against them. Yet he sees all of this. It's not like he has turned away and is not paying attention. And sometimes for us, it would seem as though God doesn't hear and he doesn't see. He might be too busy. Or he might be busy blessing other churches or other people that he's pleased with. But, you know, not me. Not us. And yet God does see and he does hear. And he is going to come and build a camp around his house, literally his temple. Because one day in Jerusalem, his glory is going to be there. He has made a promise that his glory one day will dwell in Jerusalem. That is his promise and his covenant with his people. So one day he's going to come, he's going to deliver his people, he's going to bring judgment against those heathen that God has allowed to bring in to bring judgment against them. Now, please take note. From 1 Peter chapter 2 and from other texts in the New Testament, we learn that the God is the same with his people, whether it's Old Testament or New, Old Covenant or New. And God's basic character and his basic nature is that he will use whomever he wishes to bring discipline and judgment against his people who are not walking with him as they should. He will even use the non-believers around us. He will cause them to oppress us. He will cause them to bring difficulty to us, either by way of trial to teach us to trust the Lord and to be a witness for him in the midst of the harassment or the hardship, or as a form of judgment. But all trials are a form of judgment. I don't know if you knew that or not. I can be right in my heart with the Lord, about as right as a human being can be. But my flesh is still out of whack. He's always there to say amen when I bring up myself. No matter how right my heart is with the Lord, I am still battling with the flesh, and we will see this later on too. My two worst enemies, the only two enemies that I have in this life, number one, my spiritual enemy is Satan, and my physical enemy is my flesh. Those are my two enemies. And so my heart can be so right, but my flesh can be in so rebellion and have such an influence over my mind and over my emotions that it pulls on me, even though my heart is right with the Lord. And as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9, he says, I keep my body under, I beat it black and blue. That's his attitude towards his physical body, like an athlete that would put his physical body through the tortures of preparing for the competition. You're not easy on your body. You go out and take it easy if you're going to run the mile in the Olympics. You don't go out and run just once around the track to get prepared. This is a four-lap event. You don't go out and run one lap saying, you know, I really don't want to push it. I really don't want to make it hard on the flesh. Yeah, you do. You want to go out and run about 10 miles. Build up your endurance. Push yourself, build it up and push yourself to as far as you can go. Yes, your muscles are going to hurt, but all the pain, you know, if the pain's there, you work your way through the pain. And yet we're easy on ourselves. We're easy on our flesh. Paul says, I beat it black and blue. I bring it into slavery so that after having preached the gospel, I myself should not be disqualified. Because you preach from your heart, but your flesh gets in the way. In your heart, you want to follow Christ, but the flesh gets in the way. So we have this flesh problem. No matter how right my heart is with the Lord, the trial is a form of judgment to bring hardship to that area of the flesh that is in rebellion or out of control. I am never perfectly right with the Lord. Never. I always will need trials and tribulation, because I will always need to be dealt with. I will always need judgments. I will always need the Lord's discipline to keep me in line. And yet if I complain, murmur, it's just me sympathizing with my flesh, and it's me, every time I complain and murmur, and it hurts me to say this, I do not like to say this, every time I complain, I am complaining against God and His sovereignty and His will for my life. Because whatever I have to go through every day is what He has designed for me to go through, to discipline me and minister to me and change me into the person that He would have me to be. We will see this later on as well. To murmur and complain is actually to speak against God, because He is in charge. And like I say, I hate to say that, because I catch myself getting, you know, God, why do you have... Oh, well, we don't want to go there, you know. We don't want to start getting into that. Even if the non-believers living next door, people that you work with, whatever the case may be, if they should bring oppression and harassment and difficulty, it's ordained by God, because He's allowed it to happen. And we are to submit to the hardship of those circumstances as a design by God to humble us, to bring us low. So, God is going to camp around them, but please take note that when God does eventually bring His protection and deliverance for the children of Israel against their enemies, those enemies were brought in by God. They were heathen. They were pagans. But God allowed them to come in because He was bringing judgment, a disciplinary judgment against His people. He would also bring judgment against those heathen nations. But for them, it's not going to be discipline. For them, He's going to wipe them out. So basically, God says, I can use the non-believer to come up against you, to bring you down, because you think that you're okay. You think that with your own human resources, or with your opinion, that you think that you're right with God, nothing's going to happen to you. You're not low. You're not humble. You're not depending upon the Lord. How do I know if I realize my need for Christ? It's how I respond to my trials, how I respond to my circumstances. If I submit to them, then I'm not relying on my own resources and circumstances. If I fight against it and rebel against it, then basically I know better than God. I can do it. I don't need this, you see. So, please take note that God can use anybody or anything that He wishes. Believer, non-believer, any circumstance, any kind of circumstance that He wishes, to bring us to our knees and help us to realize our need for Christ. But one day He's going to come to the Jews. I made a mention of 1 Peter chapter 2, because God says be submissive not only to the pure and the honest masters that you have to work for, but also for the crooked and the heathen. There's a submission process where you're not in submission to the person, you're in submission to God who oversees the circumstances. And if your boss or if your master happens to be a crooked heathen master, God says be in an orderly relationship with them, trusting the Lord that God has this person over you to bring certain situations into your life to humble you. So anytime the word submission is used in the Bible, it's not really to human beings. It's really to the Lord. And how we submit, we're responding to the Lord, that He knows what is best. Verse 9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. So this is back in Zechariah's day, before the deliverance had even come. And yet, these words were brought about during the entrance of Jesus into Jerusalem. Matthew chapter 21, Mark chapter 11, Luke chapter 19 all present to us the entrance of Jesus into Jerusalem, where the people laid palm branches down and they shouted for joy and they rejoiced. They were saying, Hosanna, that Messiah had come. This is what is called the triumphant entry of Jesus into Jerusalem, the Sunday before what we call Easter, the Easter celebration, which really, and again the titles come from Bibles at the top, they'll put the titles of sections, they call it the triumphant entry of Jesus into Jerusalem, and it wasn't. He rode in on a beast of burden, a donkey, and that's what you bring the sacrifices with into Jerusalem. He rode in as a humble servant to lay down his life as the Passover lamb to die for the sins of the world. At his second coming, in Revelation chapter 19, when he comes riding on a white horse, that will be his triumphant entry into Jerusalem. He rode in to lay down his life, not to conquer. They praised and hailed him as Messiah as he rode in. But at the end of the week, they had all scattered because all of their hopes were dashed when he died on the cross. They were expecting him to ride in and conquer, to ride in and free them from the Roman government and all the oppression and set up his kingdom into Jerusalem. But he didn't. He rode in, he celebrated Passover with them, and then died on the cross. Their hopes and praises turned to depression, sadness, and scattering. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is righteous and having salvation, lowly and riding on a donkey, a colt, the foal of a donkey. So that's where the quotations came from. In those chapters, again, Matthew 21, Mark 11, Luke chapter 19, all present Jesus riding into Jerusalem on the donkey in fulfillment of Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9. But there is a translation problem here that we want to address because the English translators have missed the point and missed the Hebrew translation. When it says he is righteous or just and having salvation. The term having salvation is what is termed in the Hebrew the niphel. The niphel is what is equal to the passive voice in Greek. He did not come as active voice to give salvation or make salvation. Salvation was actually expressed to Messiah. It's the Messiah who would be saved, not Messiah saving people. In fact, the Jews, the Hebrew scholars, actually have the proper translation of this text. It is we in the English-speaking world that have taken it and twisted it so that it shows that Messiah came in having salvation with him in order to save. And even though that statement is true, that's not what this text is saying. This text is saying that he is righteous, and when he rode into Jerusalem, he received salvation or rescue or deliverance when he rode into Jerusalem. That's very important. Hold your place, please, and turn with me to the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, Hebrews chapter 5. Book of Hebrews, chapter 5. Beginning at verse 5, the writer of the book of Hebrews is showing the contrast between the superiority of Jesus Christ and those people and elements of Judaism. That Christ is superior. In this section, he's talking about how Christ is superior as priest over the Aaronic system of priesthood of the Jews. Now, it is interesting that Jesus is presented as a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Sometime you ought to do a study on this character Melchizedek from the Old Testament. He was a character that just appeared on the scene. He was a priest, he was a high priest, he was also the king of Salem. He was a Gentile, which is interesting. Nobody knows where he came from, nobody knows who he is. Some people think that Melchizedek was an appearance of Christ. But according to Hebrews chapter 7, that would not match the language there, is that Jesus parallels Melchizedek in type. It does not say that Melchizedek was an appearance of Christ. There's no record of Melchizedek. He's without record of parents. He's without record of birth certificate or any history. He just was there. Nobody knows where he came from. What is interesting about this is Melchizedek is a Gentile and Jesus Christ is a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Now, if that wouldn't blow the mind of a Hebrew or Jewish person. The priesthood of Jesus Christ does not come through the Old Testament or through the Jews. Zero. None. He actually comes through a Gentile, non-Jewish priesthood. And he's trying to explain that. All of the Jews who are priests come through the family of Aaron. They are the only ones who can be priests. Jesus didn't even come from the family of Aaron, nor did he come through the priesthood of the Old Testament. He came through the priesthood of Melchizedek. It is an eternal priesthood. He is the only priest in it. So he says in verse 5 of Hebrews 5, so also Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest, but it was he who said to him, you are my son, today I have begotten you. Jesus didn't come and make himself a priest. God the Father appointed him. As he also says in another place, you are priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. It was the appointment of God. Psalms 110, other messianic psalms that declare and talk about Christ. When Messiah comes, he will be according to the order of Melchizedek, not according to the order of Aaron. Verse 7, who in the days of his flesh. So, the days in which Jesus Christ was in the flesh here on the earth, and the reference is going to be at the time when he was in the Garden of Gethsemane. You remember Jesus prayed so heavily that he prayed as and produced as great drops of blood, sweat pouring off of him as great drops of blood. And some religious groups have said he sweat great drops of blood, but he sweat as it were great drops of blood. His sweat was so thick, it was like blood. And he said to the Father, Father, if it be your will, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Some people think that Jesus was asking to be delivered from going to the cross. That he was asking the Father at this last minute if there could be some other way for salvation to be brought about other than me going to the cross and suffering the suffering of the cross. If there's some other way, Father, let it be. Nevertheless, if this is the way you want it, we'll go ahead and do it. The cup of suffering is not the cross. The cup of suffering was everything that Jesus had to suffer prior to the cross with all the mistreatment and with the abuse. So the garden prayer is not making reference to the cross. On the other hand, people use that instance of Jesus in the garden praying to the Father for him to be delivered, making reference here in verse 7, who says, who in the days of his flesh, when he offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who is able to save him from death, and was heard because of his reverence. So people make reference to the fact, and it is not correct, by the way. They say Jesus asked the Father to save him from death. And it says here that he heard his prayer because of his reverence, and so some people use that. As a matter of fact, in the early church, people used this against the church to say Jesus didn't really die. It was a fake death. And if you say he died, then this text would not be true, because when he was praying, he asked for the Father to save him or deliver him from death, and it says the prayer was answered. But yet we Christians say he died. So they say there's a contradiction in the Bible. Not so. The term from death in your English Bible, and if you're following along in your Greek text, it would be the preposition ek. If you remember from your classes, the preposition ek is from out of. Not from it, as far as keeping yourself from it, but from out of it after you're in it. This is the exact prepositional phrase that is used throughout the Scriptures to denote the resurrection. He wasn't kept from death. That's the word apo. He was delivered from out of death. That's very important. What Jesus was praying for is that the Father would deliver him from out of death itself. We're talking about the resurrection here. God the Father answered his prayer, and he was raised from the dead, and was delivered from out of death. That's very important, because the English translators still confused on technical points, because after all, even though it takes many years to produce an English translation, the English translators are trying to produce an entire Bible different from all the other translations as quickly as possible. But some of the more technical and some of the more finer points, it creates a lot of confusion, and they're trying to come up with translations that are going to fit and not cause question. The problem, going back to Zechariah chapter 9, the problem is that in Zechariah chapter 9 it says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion, shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is righteous, and He will be saved." That's how it reads. He will be the object of salvation. That is correct according to Hebrews chapter 5, verse 7. He was saved. He was delivered from out of death. He was coming in his righteousness to save, to lay down his life, like it says, on the beast of burden. He's coming in to present himself as a sacrifice, and he is coming to be saved and to be delivered from out of death, laying down his life. And that fits the translation. Now, if it were in Hebrew, I'll give you this technical word, if it meant that he was just and he had salvation in order to save others, that would be what is called the hiphil. But this is the nephal form of the Hebrew word, which is equivalent to the passive voice in Greek. Jesus was the recipient. The Messiah was the recipient of the salvation. In this case, he was saved from out of death. And so, at all the technical points of both the Hebrew Old Testament and the Greek New Testament, it all fits together. No reason to smooth it over, and no reason to try to cause problems. But of course, you know, as a translator, you have to take in consideration that when you're translating for people, that again, you're writing a translation that's not going to cause questions. If you were to read that and say, how could it pertain to Messiah, when Messiah is the one who is the object of salvation? Not giving it, but he receives it. That causes a question. They want to try to answer all the questions while you read the text, or not cause questions while you're reading the text. But that's not what it's for. We present these technical points to you because it's very important. Back in Hebrews chapter 5 at verse 7, the next verse says that Jesus learned obedience through the things that he suffered. He did not learn to obey. It doesn't say he learned how to obey. It says he learned obedience through the things that he suffered. He leaves for us an example as he submitted to the humbling process. Philippians chapter 2 says that he was in glory with God, equal to God, but he emptied himself, took on human form, and dwelt amongst us. And his occupation that he chose, again, choosing the lowly, humble part, he chose to be a servant, not a king. And instead of ruling and reigning, he submitted to death, even the death of the cross. That's what we call taking the low road, taking the humble road. When he was born, he wasn't born in a hospital. He wasn't even born at the inn or the motel. He was born in a stable. His first crib was a feeding trough for animals. This is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, Creator of the universe. You can see his attitude, which is what Philippians 2:5 says. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. The word is phrein or phroneo, the frame of mind. Let your frame of mind be influenced with the attitude in your approach to this earthly life, the same as Christ. If anybody had the right to rule as king and to be served, it was Jesus. But his approach to this earthly life was not to be served and not to rule, but to serve others and minister to the needs of others. One day he will come back and rule. Now this is important to us, and we will continue this particular topic next week about submitting to suffering and learning. For us, it's learning to obey. The Lord experienced obedience and basically expressed to us by doing so that he lives in us, that he would take us down the same road. We have to learn obedience. Jesus experienced it live, just didn't teach people. He actually did it himself. Though he was without sin, yet he lives in us, and his Spirit will take us down that same road to learn to live under our circumstances and trust the Lord, the one who did it before us, with such circumstances that you and I could not even comprehend. To lay down your life as the sin for the world is something you cannot comprehend. To go through such torture and such suffering as he did, that's beyond comprehension. To live a life that he lived is beyond comprehension. And yet we struggle with it every single day. Do you realize that every second of every day God is attempting to bring us down? Take us down the low road. Satan has a way of, especially in the culture in which we live, to pass by us like window dressing. It's like walking by the stores of the windows downtown, and they put their best merchandise out in the windows to try to catch your eye and get you to come in. Satan's window dressing. He puts the things of the world out in front of us, and we reach out and we grab it and we go for it, and we're caught in the trap. And the Lord uses that to break us and to humble us and to bring us down. To humble us that we might realize our need for Christ. That our lives might be effective for Christ. It's not effective when we parade ourselves in front of other people about how successful we are with God's help. That's not the Lord. There's a very hurting world. People are hurting. Christians are hurting. They want, or what is needed, are lives that are effective for Christ. People who are hurting and yet remaining under their circumstances, trusting in the Lord, leaning on His strength as a testimony to others that the Lord will do the same for you. You don't have to run. You don't have to fight and complain and murmur. These are all evidences of people who are being broken. We need to stop fighting and just submit. Many times we think we're fighting against Satan and we're really fighting against God. Trying to get the flesh free, trying to make things more comfortable. When in reality it's God keeping us under and disciplining us, breaking us. If we could just learn this lesson, because we spend our entire life learning one lesson, is that all these years, God has been breaking me and I have been resisting Him. Until you get to a point in your life where you at least recognize it and at least realize it and submit to God's breaking, even though it's not enjoyable. It's painful, the writer of Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 12. But only for a moment. To humble us and to break us and to discipline us. The same as the athlete puts his body through the pain and struggle of discipline, so God puts us through the paces. And yes, it's painful for the flesh. But if we see it's for our spiritual conditioning, we will submit to it as part of the training program for the goal. We just have to make sure we have the right goal. Let's close with prayer.